Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, July 16th, 1999. In the fireside room this evening is Mark Wilhelm. Today's session number is 99-8 and it's titled Public Theology for a New Millennium, Cover for a 21st Century Protestant America. Let's listen in.
Reflections on what I'm calling the search for a public theology. Something that I think is needed as we go into a new millennium in the United States. I need to review a little bit where we've been, set the stage, and add a little bit to the points I've been making this week, and then let you folks give me some feedback about what you think about the proposal as it stands at this point. Tomorrow morning, I'll be discussing my concern for developing what I'm calling a public theology in light of some findings that were developed from a study that I helped to direct at the Center for the Study of Theological Education that I'm part of in New York, where we went around the country asking people what they thought about the public role of religious leadership these days. But tonight, again, it's a review of this proposal, and I'll be trying to make the proposal a little more concrete. Tonight's a few more specific aspects of it. Oh, and by the way, I forgot to say I'm starting now, so Tape Ministries, you can start the tape. For those of you who may not have been with me so far, by public theology, I am talking specifically about what has often been so troublesome in the churches, namely the intersection of faith and public issues, these very specific practical concerns of relating religion and society, church and state, whatever you want to call it, but the impact of churches and the development of public issues or the resolution of public issues in the United States and Canada. I've argued that the basis of this concern is a presumption that many could challenge, but a presumption on my part that in a democratic society, all agencies and actors, individuals and groups, if they occupy public space in any sense, and churches certainly do, have a responsibility to participate in the decision-making surrounding public issues of the day. If we're going to be a democracy, we all have to not ignore, but participate and make our contribution toward the development of the common good. I have presented in the past a little historical background that has explained in part why people like me, I'm certainly not the only voice. Oh, and I almost forgot. Forgot last night until the very end, and most people missed it. They'll kill me in the bookstore again if I don't remember tonight. Speaking of other voices, this book, Religion in Public Life, A Dilemma for Democracy, is probably the best summary book on this matter. The author articulates the issues I'm discussing very well. It's a very readable and nice perspective on all of this. I think there are three copies left in the bookstore. Get them while they're hot. They just came in late the middle of this week, and I should also probably mention, if any of you were around last week, which I don't think is the case, or if you might be interested anyway, the book I ordered for the course last week on the history of the idea of the millennium in American religious history, American church history, is in the bookstore too, right beside this one. It's called, what is it called? The author's name is Paul Boyer, and it's When Time Shall Be No More, thinking about the idea of the millennium and end of time kind of discussions. Another good book. But lots of voices, like the author of this text, arguing that we've arrived at a time when we need to strengthen our cultural commitment to the common good, and that churches must participate in this as much as any other aspect and any other components of our culture. And the main reason for this is, from the history of the United States and the history of Christianity, is, do any of you remember the term that we're here yesterday? I know some of you were here. What's the term? What happened to religion culturally?
Disestablishment.
And, you know, by the way, if you, when I was little, there was a word that everybody said was the longest word. What was it?
Anti-disestablishmentarianism.
But you never probably thought about who was an anti-disestablishmentarian, practicing anti-disestablishmentarianism. If Protestant Christian culture has been disestablished, I need to take a step back here. I'm getting ahead of myself. The word is disestablishment, and the reason we need this new cultural thinking about how to work together to achieve the common good is that the Protestant ethos that formed so much of our common culture has broken down, and we need to find new ways to think together about our common life. And that breaking down is called by historians of Christianity the disestablishment, or the second disestablishment of Christianity. The first disestablishment in U.S. Christian history was, of course, when the Constitution was organized and we legally disestablished church and state. But after that happened, there was a long period when, although that there was no legal religious establishment, there was very much of a cultural church religious establishment, and it directed much of our notions of the common good. That's been breaking down, and so historians now talk about, in the middle of the 20th century, a second disestablishment of Christianity. So if you are people who long for the way it used to be, and you'd like to reestablish what has been disestablished, you would be an anti-disestablishmentarianism. Ist. Thank you very much. But because those good old days are hard to just achieve, you can't just wish them back, even if you don't think they were good old days, you can't wish them back. People are urging that it's a time for us, as a result of the end of the cultural establishment of the role of religion and of our culture, to find new ways to think about the common good and new ways for the churches to act to help achieve that common good. Back in the days of the cultural establishment of what we called Protestant Christian America, the churches had a very distinct and clear role. You were to, as it was said from the beginning, the churches were to make, in their public role, they were to make individuals who were people of character and virtue so they could function in our society as good citizens. And secondly, the churches were to be about the business of charitable giving and maintaining the public welfare in that manner. Because of the changes, though, in our culture, I have been arguing that we need to move to a third level of activity in the new this new time we find ourselves. The public role of the churches will continue to be about the business of forming individuals who have good character and virtue and who can function as good citizens in our society, and the churches will still be called upon to be the frontline givers of charitable acts. Every social worker I've ever known says that actually has they have complained to me in the past. I'm ordained and spent 12 years in the parish ministry, and I had regularly had the experience of social workers complaining to me that people who needed assistance would turn to the churches and the clergy first for help, because people in our culture understood that's where the real front line of assistance was. But the social workers would complain all these ministers didn't know squat about really what to do and how to help or how to get people into the networks of helping agencies and so on, and that we created as much trouble as we helped. I don't know if that's true, but that was an opinion of the people I ran into a lot. But the point is, churches have and will continue to be these frontline agencies of charitable work and assistance. However, now, because of the disestablishment of the Protestant ethos in which most of the churches operated, even the Roman Catholic churches operated within this ethos. In fact, at one time it was such a prominent ethos, historians of Christianity refer to the overarching scheme in which all of this happened as the benevolent empire, that there were these massive agencies, and we have remnants of them now, such as the Red Cross and others, but they all grew out of this massive interlocking, just commonly culturally understood network of agencies and activities, all born of the Protestant ethos in America. But now that all this is breaking down and we're in a kind of a new day and lots of social transitions going on, in addition to providing those traditional functions, the churches have to consider developing a theology of their public responsibilities, a public theology that also includes not only these kinds of one-on-one activities, helping to form you and me and others as good citizens who will go out and do their own individual thing, and charitable activities responding to individual needs, but also being agencies that function to form communities that have moral content and capacity. What I mean by that is simply, we need to be the agency that moves our culture beyond the rhetoric that says, talk about anything except religion and politics, because they're too divisive. It creates trouble. It's a problem. We could say that when the notion of political liberties and religious liberties and roles in society were clearly understood. Now that roles are up in the air, we have to talk more about religion and politics, and we have to be, the churches have to take the lead in helping people learn how to talk about these kinds of very important public issues together in a civil way, rooted in the basic assumptions of what our faith stands for and what we can commonly hold as a moral and democratic people. Religious communities, churches in particular, have been classically chastised for being the source of the hackneyed expression that religion and politics discussions just divide and are rancorous. And recent debates in recent decades over the controverted issues of our day have held that up, so that you can't have a civil discussion about abortion, for example. You just scream at each other, in effect. It's more and more vital that in our increasingly diverse and multicultural society, that the churches become safe and tutored spaces where people are taught how not only to be personally virtuous, but virtuous in the sense of being able to engage in common discussion around the controverted issues of the day, starting by, within our own congregations, helping to teach people how to do that, modeling it in discussions that happen in our own congregations, and then also being locations where the larger community can be invited in, literally, to a safe and civil space for discussions of these matters. Churches are starting to do this. One of the issues of the Alban Institute's periodical over in the reading nook. Laura, do you remember what the Alban Institute's newsletter is called? Congregation, I think, is the name of it. Congregation. It has an article about it. A large cathedral in California that regularly hosts a large cross-section of public leaders and political leaders, social leaders, and others to discuss issues in this manner, creating a safe space for these kinds of things to go on. The second thing that the church needs to do to pick up this role, in addition to local congregations being a focus of communal moral formation, the churches need to sponsor, in my view, the creation of vehicles for the laity to devote their skills to the resolution of public issues. We have a model over the last few decades of pastors being out there, taking the lead in churches, pointing out and calling together people to consider what should be done, kind of thing. The model from the civil rights movement days. In the changed conditions now, we need, in addition to that first aspect of congregational life, we need to be sponsoring through the churches the development of study centers, institutes, programs, I don't know what you call it, but we need to be spending some money creating institutional vehicles where people, Christians, the lay members of our churches, who have talents related to the critical public issues of our day, can work on them. The best model for this is what has come of the so-called Washington offices for public affairs. I don't know if you folks are aware, but through most of the century, most of the churches have had representatives in Washington, D.C. Most of them were sent to Washington, D.C. to represent the interests of the churches, to make sure First Amendment privileges and rights weren't prohibited or weren't being compromised by the government, or to coordinate things like military chaplaincy and so on. But they've grown through the years to be places where talented members of our churches who knew something related to health care or knew something related to public welfare issues or so on, or campaign finance reform, could gather and work on these and provide an astute form of opinion to our legislators. I one time asked the director of that agency, this is now 20 years ago, why the committees of the Congress would want to hear from these small agencies representing the various denominations. And he said it was because they were sort of like lobbyists who didn't have an axe to grind. So the congressmen liked to hear the insights that these folks could bring because it gave a kind of perspective that had some integrity to it, but wasn't always asking for something particularly in return. It's a good model. We need to be developing more of those kinds of things. Now, there are lots of people who think I'm nuts, that this is all a bit pretentious and would never get anywhere anyhow, that the idea of setting up these kinds of think tanks or institutes for talented members of our churches to come together and spend some time is just a little too overblown, and you'll never get churches to become these places of encouraging civil discussion, because we can't get a civil discussion, as Deanne Lagerquist was telling me. Oh, I don't think she'll mind me telling this story if you know Deanne. As Deanne Lagerquist told me over dinner, she can't even get a civil conversation about changing the stained glass windows at St. John's, let alone controversial or troublesome public issues of the day. There are others, though, who think I'm crazy for more concrete reasons. I guess they would break down into three groups, and I will give them these names. I need to say it very clearly. This is, again, sort of the Mark Wilhelm take on things. You won't find this stuff in any books, and you won't find it in, go to some expert on the, I mean, there'll be implications of what I'm saying in this book, but these categories and some most of the other stuff I'm telling you is mine, so, you know, there's good reason to think it doesn't make much sense. I actually got four categories of people who are concerned about it, but it's only the first three that I'm just going to sort of dismiss. The fourth one, I want to think a little more about. First one are the sectarians. Now, these aren't sectarians in the sense that that word is usually meant. The word sect or sectarian tends to raise sort of the idea of crazies in people's minds. These are some of the most reputable and distinguished leaders in our country. The most important leader of the sectarians is a Methodist theologian by the name of Stanley Hauerwas, who teaches at the Divinity School at Duke University. Highly regarded. But he's given up on thinking about the churches having any possible responsible role in impacting public issues. And it's not because he thinks the churches don't have some good things to say. He just thinks that the secularization of our society is so advanced and the moral bankruptcy of our society is so advanced that it's pointless. He said, will America, U.S. and Canada will go on just fine. We'll make money and do good things, generally speaking, and won't be absolutely, totally corrupt. But the idea of truly improving anything is impossible along the lines of a Christian vision. And so he thinks all the churches can do is, you know, not find a desert island and hang out there together, but be here, do our own Christian thing, and at best, model what really a good society would look like by the way we treat one another and live together, but we have no business trying to take our model and, I guess he would say, impact or impose it on the rest of American culture, not because he thinks that's being heavy-handed, he just thinks it's a waste of time. It's a classic sectarian view that in the history of the churches, sectarians have always been the people who have not necessarily left a society, but like the classic example in U.S. culture and Canada, the Amish, who are part of America, but they live apart, and they would probably say they are modeling the way Christians really should live, but they make no attempt to impact public issues or decision-making in U.S. society. Stanley Hauerwas and the rest of those folks think we should all become just like the Amish in our approach to life. And he would say, I'm nuts. And the other group I call, appropriately, the reactionaries. I've already, it begins, that's not right. Well, Aries. Yeah, that's close enough. reactionaries. That's why I always lost at spelling bees. I can actually spell reasonably well. My wife would say that's not true. But I really can't spell standing up or talking. I always went down in the second round. I got through the first round. The words were really easy. But I always went down in the second round of the spelling bee. And teachers were always disgusted with me. The reactionaries are these anti-disestablishmentarians, the folks who would like to take it back to the way it was. There has always been, they would say, a public role for the churches. And these are the folks, however, who like to talk about the founders, the founding fathers of America. And they will say, that's the way it should be. Ben Franklin talked about the public religion of America. And by that he meant the kind of cultural establishment of Protestantism. The founder, it's easy to find in the founders the kind of argument for a classic Protestant Christian America public role of religion, because they were so concerned, their concern was not allowing a legal state church in the United States. So they could not conceive of an overbearing or singular Protestant Christian American culture that might be an issue at some point. So their texts don't talk about it. So if you read them, at least superficially, it sounds like they're endorsing what we have now just lost. So there are many reactionaries trying to recapture it. However, if these folks were to read deeper into the writings of the founders, they would discover that those guys who lived long enough, and Franklin was not one of them, if they read into the guys who lived long enough, they too began to question the close linkage between a Protestant Christian America idea and having America build its social structures and the role of Christian churches solely in the light of that. So, for example, a guy named James Madison, important organizer of the Constitutional Convention, fourth president of the United States in the early cabinets. Which end is this? This end. And he, at the same time, he was in his committee passing the document that became the Bill of Rights in the first House of Representatives, and passing that on to be adopted by both houses and sent out to the states for adoption. He was also, through his committee on the judiciary, passing the first a resolution to elect a chaplain for the House of Representatives. And that's often lifted up as an example of how just because we say we don't establish religion or so on doesn't mean we can't have public officials who are religious and the like. Madison also, when he was president, issued Thanksgiving Day proclamations, for example. But when he was an older man in the 1830s, he spoke against both. Why? Because America was increasingly becoming, in that day, a diverse country. What was the diversity? The large influx of Irish and German Roman Catholics. And he said, you know, you guys in the House would never elect a Roman Catholic priest House chaplain, would you? There was also a growing Jewish community on the eastern seaboard cities. You would never elect a rabbi, a House chaplain, would you? We have his correspondence on this. He said, there should be no more House chaplains. He said, we have established de facto, we have established religion in the United States. And there was a de facto cultural establishment of Protestantism, which I said didn't break down until the middle of this 20th century. He said, we should also stop, therefore, issuing Thanksgiving Day proclamations. He said, it is part of a de facto establishment of Protestantism. If he had lived long enough, he would probably have said, we should stop praying the Lord's Prayer in all of the schools. He said, first of all, if you're a Roman Catholic, you don't have exactly the same text, and it's not the Lord's Prayer. It's the Our Father. But the cultural establishment continued at the World Parliaments of Religion. With the World's Fair, the Columbian Exposition in Chicago in the 1890s, the American Protestant establishment actually got Buddhist monks and Hindu leaders who came to that to recite the Lord's Prayer in public because it was lifted up as the perfect ecumenical prayer. But what it was, of course, was a perfect expression of the Protestant cultural establishment. That's what, however, these guys are trying to invoke when they call on the founding fathers, as they always will refer to them as the founding fathers instead of the founders, and will try to hope that we can recapture that idea. The third group I call the prophetic group. These folks say I'm nuts because both liberals and conservatives who make this up, religious liberals and religious conservatives, say that the only proper role of the churches is not this kind of contribution to a civil discussion about how the issues should be resolved, but it is making the prophetic stance, taking the religious authority, the authority of truth that God has given us, and saying this is what it must be. And that if there's nothing like that to be done, the churches should just recede. So on both conservative sides and liberal side, you have those saying, I'm going to pick these four issues, and the church must say this. We got to get with this is it, you know. And they say I'm nuts for proposing this more knee-jerk moderate, as I would be accused of, approach to public issues and calling for a consensus-building, moral formation of community, constructive approach to these kinds of matters. So there are plenty of opponents out here, but there's a fourth group that I'm more concerned about speaking to you tonight, and then in the time remains, getting some reaction to all of what I've said, but particularly these last concerns. And these are not the opponents, but a fourth group that, for lack of a better phrase, I'll call the worriers. And these aren't people who are worriers because they're worried that what I'm proposing it might be difficult to accomplish, as I said earlier, but they are troubled that the talk of achieving this kind of a leadership on public theology by people like me, a straight nuclear family representative white guy who might be just a bunch of reactionary reality in disguise. Here's how I get this. And this is why in the blurb that I sent around, I said, is a public theology a John Foster Dulles theology? Does anybody remember who John Foster Dulles was? Who was John Foster Dulles?
Secretary of State.
He was Secretary of State in whose administration?
Kennedy.
Even back further, Eisenhower. He had to be medieval to know this stuff. You know? Huh?
Amen.
Amen. Amen. Now, what you really got to know about John Foster Dulles is he's like the quintessential Protestant cultural establishment kind of guy. The Dulles family, I work at Auburn Seminary. Auburn Seminary is now in New York City and is associated with Union Seminary, but it gets its name because it was organized in the town of Auburn, New York, in upstate around Rochester, Syracuse, you know, the Finger Lakes region of New York State. The Dulles family is from Auburn, and there have been some distinguished people. There's a distinguished, now he converted from this Presbyterian family, became a Roman Catholic, Avery Dulles, is one of the... Matt, did you ever hear about Avery Dulles? And that's because you study with these liberals like Dan Spencer at Drake, thank you, in Des Moines. Avery Dulles, major Roman Catholic theologian, other scholars and other leaders, but the most famous of the Dulles family... One of the Dulleses had Macy in their middle name, so you know how tied they were into the, as in a Macy's department store chain, really tied into the Protestant establishment. The most famous, however, was John Foster Dulles, became Secretary of State during the Eisenhower administration, a Presbyterian who was on the board of directors of Auburn Seminary and Union Theological Seminary in New York, who became a real good buddy with Dwight Eisenhower when he was president of Columbia University right after the Second World War, getting positioned to be elected president, always came to chapel at Union Theological Seminary, got to know old John Foster, packed him off to Washington, and whenever John Foster wanted to know what should be doing, you know, with in terms of public issues and how to make things shake, rattle, and roll when the Cold War, would talk to, need to talk to a Christian ethicist at Union Seminary. Who's available? You know, Union Theological Seminary, the quintessential Protestant establishment school. And people by the names of that you may not recognize now, but very famous in their era, Reinhold Niebuhr and John Bennett and others, were almost a kitchen cabinet for the State Department of the United States of America at the height of the Cold War. Now, you can't get any more sort of Protestant establishment than that. And old President Eisenhower came to New York when it was time, in 1958, was it? No, late in his second term, to dedicate the Interchurch Center, the home of the National Council of Churches, right around the corner from Union Theological Seminary and right next door to the Cathedral of Protestant establishment called the Riverside Church. And if any of you have been to New York, there's a little compound there. A lot of people, when I raise the issues that we've been discussing this evening, kind of wonder, as I said, when guys like me start talking about this, are you really talking about getting back to the heyday of John Foster Dulles? And it's not just people who are kind of been conventionally marginalized from religion, even some religious leaders who come out of traditions outside of mainstream Protestantism. In fact, I take the name of this as a concern of a John Foster Dulles reaction from a fellow who's the president of Fuller Seminary. I think I may have mentioned this to you the other day, Woody, that I was speaking with him about this, and actually we were having a meeting, and he was questioning this public theology stuff, and he's saying, well, who's public, you know, and what theology, and who's going to decide what public is going to be gathered to determine what this is? Basically, it's a question of who's going to decide what good we're going to hold in common. When we talk about gathering people together in these proposals I've made to reshape the common good, but it's who's commonness, you know, what? Whose idea of the common? What's going to be shared that is good? There are lots of people who have different perspectives on exactly what the good is. How will we decide what is to be held in common? And there are questions that come. Are we more mainstream establishment Protestant types just trying, under the guise of some new ways of saying it, reestablish our old cultural control? I hear this from, as I've mentioned already, evangelicals. Certainly feminists raise this when I bring it up, who question whether the concerns they have will be brought in. I hear it from gay and lesbian peoples when this is discussed. Anybody who has in any way been burned in the past or to some extent marginalized by the old Protestant cultural consensus will almost automatically worry about this call for a new conversation about common good, for fear that once again the old common togetherness that was togetherness for some folks but not all folks might be calling for a reactionary move in disguise, just not as overt as the federal judge, it's a federal judge or is it a state judge down in Alabama, who wanted to mount the Ten Commandments on the courtroom wall. He's a little more blatant, but they're wondering whether my proposal is a subtle way of doing it. The fellow whose name I can never remember, of course, wants to make certain that the Ten Commandments posted on the wall, I'm sure, are the Ten Commandments as they're ordered by the traditional Protestant establishment rendering, where 1 through 10 includes number 2 as a prohibition of graven images. This is an inside joke for the Lutherans. You know that number 2, if you studied your catechism, what's the second commandment? It's not a prohibition of graven images, but what? I am shocked! I am shocked! You shall not take the name of the... You shall, that's a person who learned her catechism. Yeah. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. That's not going to be number 2 on the wall in Alabama. Number 2 is going to be graven images. Number 2, right? Presbyterians here, right? Yeah. Number 2. Right. See, Presbyterians are part of the old Protestant establishment. But we Lutherans are part of the Roman Catholic ethnic tradition. As much as we, you know, this anti-papist thing, as the Presbyterians who came to my church in New Waterford, Ohio, after the Presbyterian church functionally folded, they had a hard time. So Joyce Grossen shows up for my class in school, suddenly shows up in my Sunday school class. And we've already gone through the service, because unlike most churches, we were a little church in the country, so we had Sunday school after church, instead of the conventional Protestant before church, because the pastor had to do our service early and then go back to the big town, you know, for the congregation. Anyway, we're getting there, sitting there, and she said, I was kind of surprised, you know? It seemed okay, she said. I always thought that you guys were just Catholics without the Pope. And we are out of that, I didn't say it at the time, but she was basically right on target, in a sense. In terms of traditions, ethos, we're part of that ethnic, the Lutherans are part of this ethnic separation from the Protestant cultural hegemony. And so we number the commandments differently. And we see graven images as an extended commentary on the first commandment, you shall have no other gods before you. And it's just been this extended commentary about not making any idols. And then we go number 2, don't swear, you know, don't take the name of the Lord your God in vain. And then we separate all the covets into 2. Number 9 is you shall not covet your neighbor's house. Number 10, all those cattle and stuff. For the Reformed tradition, these Protestant establishment types over here, they squash all those into 1. That's all 10. All the covets go together. Now, if you go to Judaism, it gets even more complicated, because they don't even think we got the right set. There's another rendering of the Ten Commandments later in the book of Exodus that gives more extensions than even graven images and tells you to remember to keep this festival and that festival in relation to these commandments. So when he's putting up the Ten Commandments, you see, on the wall, which he thinks is just a good old way of reaffirming values, what he's doing again is being one of these guys who's actually asserting the cultural prominence of a certain kind of Protestant ethos. Yes.
The Ten Commandments, I've got to go read them now. See what they had over at Jackson County Courthouse, and a guy that was trying to get them to take them down. So So that's a big deal in that part of the state.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's also a movement to have the Ten Commandments in schools now.
Yes.
So it's several things like that.
Yeah. It seems like something, and I suppose many people are, you know, genuinely motivated, I suppose. But and it seems innocent enough, but it really is a packaging of a certain, it's a very symbolic statement, not only about what people wanted to say, that is a commitment to a certain ethical values that are thought to be held in common, but it is a symbol that represents very much, as I tried to explain, by just the simple differences within the so-called Judeo-Christian tradition of the reading of the Ten Commandments. I somewhat smart-alecky reference to the so-called Judeo-Christian tradition, because all you have to do is talk to a Jew, and they will tell you, talk to most rabbis, and they will give the same reaction, kind of excited reaction, that I gave to the posting of the Ten Commandments. That just as I said, that's a ruse for symbolizing an attempt to get back to a cultural priority for a Protestant Christian America. They say Christians talking about the Judeo-Christian heritage is a way of absorbing Judaism and Jews into, again, a Protestant Christian ethos, that term was invented. They said there's no Judeo-Christian heritage unless you think of Judaism as being preparatory to the now replacement New Testament, that it comes, you know, in that line of progression. They said, what Judeo-Christian heritage? It's just the Jewish heritage that we're trying to preserve. What I'm really appealing for in all of this, I guess, is especially to these worriers. What I want to say is that my focus in calling for congregations to be places of an kind of an ethical procedure, not just we're concerned about ethical substance, but my now is in our day of multicultural America, we need an ethical procedure where the focus on the common good and the way we go about it is not a fixed view of something in particular other than the concern for equality and freedom and mutual respect. Those kinds of procedural goals that the churches and the synagogues and the other places of worship in this nation would become places where people of all sorts can come together to achieve a new kind of common good that's based upon freedom, equality, and mutual respect. Combining all of that together in a way that will help us to achieve a new, more common culture in the midst of all the changes that are going on. The reason why folks worry about it is not only that it can be a way of imposing the older standards, but also that it will just lead to chaos and that we'll never be able to get anywhere. It'll be too hard. But again, I appeal that to the hope that this is where the American, I'm going to appeal to some old rhetoric just like the reactionaries, where the American dream will really continue. Most people think of the American dream in terms of a house and a garage, getting an education, getting a good job, having the yard and all of that in kind of economic and acquisitive terms. And I wouldn't want to actually deny there's an important aspect of that, although we can get down on the acquisitiveness stuff. But the old, to use the older 19th century language, everybody getting 40 acres and a mule is a very important statement about the democratic ideals of America, that everybody will have an equal share and a chance to fully participate. That every time that hasn't happened so far, our culture has largely responded to the need to make the correctives. And I've said before, we're in a time when we need to be doing that, as too much of the investment capacity and too much of the political power is being concentrated in our day in smaller and smaller circles. When that happened 100 years ago, somehow our culture was able to keep the American dream alive and make tremendous reforms. It was called the Progressive Movement. We spread out political power with direct election of senators and suffrage for women and the like. We redistributed investment power by amending the Constitution to institute the progressive income tax, by requiring that monopolies and trusts be broken up, and that the land that was being gobbled up by the railroads and other business interests started to be purchased by the federal government or held by the federal government, the start of the federal lands and parks programs to ensure that the democratic, economic, and social and political basis of our society was maintained. I see my proposals as part of reclaiming the American dream, that we can, in fact, be a place where, despite all of the baggage of global culture that says if you don't hold everything to a single definition of a common good, like a legally established religion, we gave up on that. All cultures prior to the United States, and most still to this day, say if you don't have a legally established religion, your society will fall into chaos. You gotta have that in common. We've proven that not to be the case. Now we are trying to prove that a culturally established religion and a certain common ethos, common good in that sense, defined by this Protestant Christian America ideal, or even something a little broader than that, Catholic, Protestant, Jew. You know, we don't have to have it just that narrow, but we can keep expanding the family of America around these principles of equality and mutual respect and freedom, and that it won't degenerate into chaos. As long as we have the procedural, ethical commitment, the political one equivalent to this is majority rule. Right? That's the fundamental bedrock rule of America politically, and a mutual respect that you'll participate in the political process. Culturally and socially, we need to expand the basis of a commitment to a procedural ethic where we'll gather together around what I've been calling for, this ethic of community building that the churches will take the lead on. Even as we've done such a good job of being communities where individual ethical formation was emphasized, now we need to focus our attention in the churches on forming ourselves as people who know how to live and talk civilly together in community around the issues that need to be resolved in our day. That's my speech for the week. We got 5 minutes. Anybody want to have any reaction? I started out a week and a half ago by being the politician on the 4th of July, and I gave the 4th of July oration. You got my oration for this week on this matter. I want you to go back to your churches and convince all your congregations to start this. Tell them they got to not only be worried about teaching everybody how to be good, build character in themselves, but also this collective character of being able to be a group and talk about issues. Yes?
Question. What was the public theology of this Protestant era that you spoke of? And when was that era specifically or generally?
It's labeled by historians of Christianity from 1833 until 1930. Now, you got to fudge that a little bit because these things don't exactly like stop and start on a dime. But 1833, because that's when the state of Massachusetts voted to disestablish the Congregational Church. It was the last established religion in the United States. So from 1791, Bill of Rights, 1833 was the period when the United States of America worked out this thing we call the legal disestablishment of religion.
I think he's talking about the John Forster Dulles crowd.
Yeah, I'll explain that. So from 1833 to to 1930 is when the historians label it. Now, I'm arguing that John Foster Dulles was part of it because just like a lot of Lutheran churches who build their Sunday school wings, just as the big Sunday school goes out of existence, right? I don't know if any of you have experienced this. Maybe not in the Pacific Northwest, but back east, certainly. The big Sunday school wing would take, kids would be falling out of the windows, and by the time they got up enough congregational nerve to build the big Sunday school wing, then suddenly the Sunday school, the baby boom was over, and they didn't need it. Between 1930 and 1960, there was a waning of the Protestant cultural establishment. But just like the church is building the Sunday school wing as it's all falling apart, the 1950s and the Eisenhower administration, the forming of the National Council of Churches and the building of the National Council of Churches building was the equivalent. It was a last gasp of this cultural establishment that was falling apart all over the country. And the John Foster Dulles time was the last gasp of the institutionalization of that. But immediately upon that having occurred, what happened? A Roman Catholic was elected president. Never could have happened in Protestant establishment America, which is why I say between 1930 and 1960, the institutional frameworks were still in existence, and it was still being the establishment was still being perpetuated at the elites, but culturally across the United States, it was being dissipated. And also during that time was when conservative evangelicalism was hidden from view. People thought it had sort of disappeared because of the Scopes trial and all that. But those folks were busy building their institutional frameworks and structures in that period. And suddenly, in the late 1960s, it blossoms in full bloom. It seems like, where did this come from? For 40 years, 30, 40 years, people with those convictions were busy getting their act together while the old line Protestant establishment was collapsing. What the theology was like is summarized this way. What I mean by the theology of the public role of the churches is a theologically driven articulation of what the public action and work of the churches should be. And in those years, as I outlined at the beginning, it was principally to say that the churches were to take the role of this building of individual moral and virtuous people and the provision of public charities.
Mark, any nations around the world that have tried to model and had any insights or success with the idea?
Best example, no, not on a determined manner like I'm suggesting, where we're just going to say we're going to do this. But it was driven by the crises in the what we called the Iron Curtain nations. If you can think back to the late 80s and early, 88, 89, 90, when the changes occurred after the fall of the Berlin Wall, I guess that would be 89, it was the churches that were the focal point of the discussions. And most observers attribute the lack of bloodshed in most of, let's say, for example, East Germany, to the activities around those remnant Christian churches in those eastern states, bringing together all of the parties to, in a civil way, discuss what needed to be done to, in response to the rapid changes that were occurring socially and culturally and politically in those states, particularly in Leipzig, in Germany, and several other cities. It's those churches that were credited with that, so we could look at that as a model, but I don't know of any place where the kind of thing that I'm suggesting exactly has occurred. Yes.
Speaking as a Calvinist.
Yes.
It's the Lutheran crowd.
Yes.
Tell you about a thing that we have been working on, because there is a remnant of a long history of public theology in Presbyterian tradition.
Yes.
Calvin and the whole idea of the orders of creation and so forth, all mm-hmm. of that lends itself to that. And around the country, about during the last 20 years, there began a kind of spontaneous outgrowth of things called city clubs or Commonwealth clubs. There's maybe 20 to 30 of them all together around the country. They've been picked up by National Public Radio. And they're
They're
all very local. Mm-hmm. They are non-affiliated with each other. But without exception, the common theme is they're searching for to find expression or give voice to the issue of what will improve or increase the common common good. Mm-hmm. And so when I moved to Spokane, which is a downtown congregation, there wasn't one in Spokane. We started one as a congregation offering a city club, only we called it a city forum because the word city club was used elsewhere with other meaning. And every month we have a speaker who speaks on a topic.
Okay.
Often these are national speakers, well-known mayors, or they're regionally well-known people.
Right.
What is the common good?
Right.
Luncheon format, feedback, questions and answers, and so forth.
Yeah.
But in a sense, what we're trying to do is to find a place for the voice of the church to be a servant to the common good, with the hope that, A, it may be productive and help the city be a better city. That's our continual theme.
Yeah.
Secondly, that it will be a place for the church to find a new voice that it actually cares about the good of the city. Mm-hmm. And it's been shocking how well received it has been. It also is now being rebroadcast on National Public Radio.
Right.
It's the only one in the country that I know of that is sponsored by a congregation.
Yes, and I need to correct what I said earlier about... I know of no massive national examples, you know, in cultures or nations, and it's certainly not done all over the place in this country, but it is springing up in spots like at your church and elsewhere around the country, and there's a lot to be learned from what's been developed elsewhere. Well, we're out of time, over time. Thank you for coming. Concludes tonight. Come back tomorrow morning, 10:45.